bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Ooh, back in the Weird Things saddle.
Now, being Easter and that Brian Brushwood is a responsible human being with a whole brood of kids, he may come in at some point, but we can't expect him to be here throughout. So we'll see.
The text message that me and Andrew got was, plan on me being there for some point, but I need to go find out how long that is.
Yes. So, you know, sometimes you hide those eggs and it takes a while to find them.
It does, yeah. You know, next thing you know, you wake up, it's the 4th of July, and you've got a couple hard-boiled eggs kicking around.
Let me ask you a question, Justin. You ever go on an Easter egg hunt when you're a kid?
Oh, yeah. No, it was always a big thing. As the biggest thing was that, like, everybody then, like, I guess I really don't like eggs all that much. Like, I don't like hard-boiled eggs, so it was seemingly, I don't know. There was just all sorts of factors to it that made me not enjoy it. At least not as much as, like, it being kind of like another everybody gets together and eats food kind of holiday, like in Thanksgiving and in Christmas vein. That's pretty much the only, like, fancy dinner holiday in the spring of its kind, which I always enjoyed.
Well, when I was a kid, I lived in Oregon, and there was this we lived in this community where we had our own little park, and they used to do this Easter egg hunt, and it was pretty awesome because it was a big park up on a hill, and they'd hide the plastic eggs, like the ones filled with cool stuff, jelly beans, candy, sometimes cash prizes. They'd put little numbers on them, which kind of cool. I once thought I found a number one, which was like the biggest prize. I brought it up to the judge. I'm so proud of myself, and she takes it. She wipes the blade of grass off of it.
Oh, no. Like,
no! But do you ever do that? Like, you find cool stuff? Like, you know, sometimes my parents would, like, hide, like, money and stuff in them.
No, we went with straight eggs. Like, there was definitely, like, we didn't have the gimmicked plastic eggs with stuff inside of it. It was just eggs. We made – it was really – and it was a forced labor kind of situation because – like, we had to make the eggs, like, the day before, and then then the parents hid them, and then we had to go look for them. It was like we were doing all the hard work.
That sucks. Can I tell you, that sucks. You made the eggs, you set these eggs up, and then the eggs are gone, and then you got to go find them again.
Yeah. It's like, never fly in your adult life. You would never be like, oh, you worked really hard for your paycheck. Oops, guess you have to find it now.
Is there a coincidence this happens around tax day? I'm just saying.
I feel like this is the wrong time for me to show up in this conversation.
No, it's the perfect time.
Got done doing exactly that. Like, the kids assembled all of their eggs. They picked what jelly beans went in them. They had a big basket, and then they made a carrot cake. They made, like, a carrot and celery stew. They made a salad. And to make the Easter Bunny feel at home, they wrapped the whole presentation inside a cage because apparently that's what rabbits like in their imaginations is to go eat in cages. And they had a nice note saying, thank you for hiding our Easter eggs. And then they went nuts and did that today.
So, but you used the plastic ones of stuff in them.
Yeah. We didn't like we all remember the stinky freaking, you know, vinegar and whatever dyes that we would do to and actually hard boiled eggs. How dumb was that, by the way, back in the day?
Paz? That's the Paz dynasty there, bro.
Like, get out of here, Paz. I'm Neg. If you're Paz, I'm Neg.
So you put stuff so you can have cool stuff you could find in the eggs.
Yeah, sure. We got jelly beans. We got chocolates. We got money in a bunch of them.
And you guys, and partly you guys have to do that because you have egg allergy issues.
Well, yes. Right? I mean, that's the weird thing too. This weird, like, celebration of egg culture. This pro egg agenda has to end. You know, Penelope, of course, is deathly allergic to eggs.
So obviously Brian's here on the podcast. Brian, welcome to the Weird Things Show.
Yay! Sorry, it took me a little bit to show up. I feel bad that I showed up late, but I'm
no
glad
worries.
I'm already in the middle
We're
of
glad
it.
Glad to have you.
We're jumping right into it here. So here's the thing. A woman in Tennessee decided to set up a little Easter egg hunt for her little boy, and she made quite a discovery.
Okay.
Care to guess?
She went on an Easter egg hunt and she found something?
Yeah. She was boiling up the egg.
I'm going to guess that she found, like, rattlesnake eggs, thinking they were Easter eggs.
Ooh, that's good.
I'm going to say, and by the way, a cagey move to go right for snake, since normally we end up at snake on all of these scenarios. I'm going to say she found that her or the young boy found a body part. They found, like, something severed.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you this question now. Brian, where are some of the places you've hidden Easter eggs?
Let's see. Underneath like the piano seat, underneath like a drum, behind the couch, underneath like the futon and the ottoman. Those are the
no
good.
Outside? No outside?
Oh, no. Well, okay. First of all, let's face it. Like, the reason that our Easter Bunny only put stuff downstairs and not in Dad's office is because we're lazy.
Okay.
And because the Easter Bunny hates Dad's office, as does Dad hate Easter Bunnies coming into his office and putting things.
Well, there's just a game recognized game kind of agreement between Dad and the Easter Bunny that he doesn't like people all up in his office, and the Easter Bunny has no desire to tread there.
See, we're on one mind, me and the Easter Bunny.
So this woman's out and back hunting down eggs with her son. She notices a smell. She looks underneath the deck and sees a pair of shoes and a horrible smell.
No.
She's like, why don't you go inside, honey? Mommy's going to take care of this. Sure enough, dead body under the deck.
What? So this is their family home. They're not at some different little cottage that they go to for these kind of occasions. Like, this is like just their regular old deck.
This is the regular deck. This is just some guy crawled underneath there. They think maybe died of natural causes. Police are still trying to determine who the man was and why he was under the deck.
Oh, my God. See, at least this one is like a random finding. That's like that you find a body underneath your hotel room mattress in Vegas or whatever. Like, what was it, like last month? Did you see that story about like a mom who admitted like her ex, the chick splits with her husband, and admits after getting caught, like the husband in the divorce got the house, goes out in the garage cleaning out stuff, discovers like the shoe boxes with the infants that she had smothered and left in a shoebox after.
Oh, good God.
Yeah, dude, this is like dark stuff. And so he reports it, and she's like, oh, yeah, no, I definitely killed like 6 or 7 kids between 1995 and now.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's super dark. Super dark.
Yeah, that's some dark stuff.
I'll tell you what.
Happy Easter, everybody.
That totally blew out of the water my story about how I one time I didn't realize that a mouse was decomposing in the warehouse me and Andrew used to have in Margate. There was it smelled really, really bad for a while, but I just think, because again, this is just a warehouses in South Florida, right?
Justin would have a garbage can filled to the top with empty coffee cups of varying degrees of emptiness there.
Yes.
So there was this
awful. It was awful. It was rank. And I assumed it was coming from the bay next door, because the guy there was just like this real, like,
mouse.
I have no idea what he did in there. He was moving out. He was doing stuff. And I'm like, I don't know what the hell he's working with, but it stinks something awful. And then it all died down. I never thought about it. And then we were consolidating down from 2 warehouses to 1. I move this dresser, and there is just the skeleton of a decomposed mouse behind the dresser.
Dude, that was didn't they open up like a dance club next to you guys, like in the last 20 minutes you were there or something?
Oh no, that was Huapos. No, there was like a series of dance clubs, and we're getting kind of farther and farther away. But like, there was just, it was like this kind of area where there was a bar, and it was either a dive bar or it eventually became a dance club. But I was happy when Huapos, the possibly Latin themed gay nightclub, opened, because it was better than the one before, which was just like the honky tonk where a bunch of white people drinking, blue collar style, like bar that was there before, where my car got broken into three times because it attracted such a.
Finally, you attracted the better clientele of the
posse. Dude, if they were just there to listen to some reggaeton and grind up on each other's booties, that's fine, man. Those people weren't breaking into my car.
So back to this story for a moment. The story about the dead body under the deck for Easter.
Yeah.
When do you break it to the kid? At some point, you're going to want to tell – the family's going to know the story. At what point do you tell them, hey, remember that Easter?
There's only one person who has any chops to answer this, and that is the person who has three kids running around. My thought is, first, Brian, confirm or deny, you have to let people know that – you have to let the kids know that this isn't the Easter Bunny.
Right. No, okay, first of all, the kids never find out that it's a body. What you do is you find some technically accurate euphemism to describe what's happening right now. You could say
giant
like
dead mouse.
Well, or what you could say is like, well, somebody found something important underneath the deck and
treasure?
We're
going to be your kids and we want you to tell us this, okay?
All right, here we go. Let's back it up. Okay, so like, well, it turns out that there's a situation with the previous owners of this house, and they found something important underneath the deck.
Was it the Easter Bunny?
No. Goodness no, kids. It's
gold?
I can say it wasn't gold, and it wasn't the Easter Bunny.
What's that fan in the hiding that says forensics?
You know what? That's adorable that you could read that word, and we're really proud of you for that. And come here, give me a hug. Who wants ice cream?
Yay, ice cream! Yeah.
And you do that until they're 23, and then you're drinking on the porch with your 23-year-old daughter, and you're like, oh, yeah, no, did you? Okay, that was a dead body. They found a dead man underneath.
Okay. Now, your oldest, though, Penny.
Yeah.
Whip smart, extraordinarily curious.
Yeah.
Are you to the point where you got to clue her in on maybe a slightly more illustrative truth than the younger two?
She's not at the point – here's the problem. At 10 years old, she can also easily be distracted. Like, there's no amount of curiosity that will not be overwhelmed with, hey, you want to go watch the Lego movie again? You know, yeah. Like that kind of thing. It's like at this point, we could still go somewhere else. But, like, if she was 13, then I would switch and I would make her part of the team. I'm like, all right, listen up, kid. Here's the thing. Found a body. Can't let the rest of the kids know. Don't lie. Because I don't know if I've told you guys this, but like we're trying this ongoing experiment and we're 10 years into it and we haven't had to lie to the kids yet, except for Santa Claus. Santa Claus is very much lying about Santa Claus.
The biggest lie of them all.
Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, and the Easter Bunny. But
mommy and daddy wrestling.
Those are all magic tricks, right?
So the third one, I mean, they are technically wrestling. Like,
yes, exactly. But outside of that, like we're trying this experiment to see if we can just not lie to the kids our entire lives, and so far we haven't. You know, like even questions about Santa Claus. You know, it's like we'll dodge, we'll answer questions with questions, or we'll say like, well, how do you feel about Santa Claus, or what do you think, or, you know, that kind of thing. So, but at 13, I would put Penny to that test where like, here's the thing, we're not allowed to lie to the other kids, but the kids shouldn't know that they're digging up a body over there, so here are some of the tools that your mom and I have been using. You're on the team now, go.
And so the key is just she hasn't been able to lock jaw onto an idea and just not let it go to the point where you have to deal with it.
Not yet, but puberty's coming.
Yeah. All right.
And with that, her sassafras idea maker.
We're going to check in with this periodically to see how this experiment goes. In other news, gentlemen, Friday, something awesome kind of happened.
Yeah, yeah. Jesus done for your sin, asshole.
Yeah.
And
you have to be a jerk about it, Brian.
We had the big old launch there.
Oh, that too. Yeah. Hey,
by the way, I want you to know, like, I tuned in to listen to the press conference afterwards, and they were a little bit coy like, out of everything, like, there's questions about, like, what the payloads were. Did you put any Easter surprises in there and that kind of crap? I'm like, these are dumb questions. I hate these.
But just quickly fill in for those listening who are not aware of what we're talking about. SpaceX did a launch on Friday, a delayed launch. Finally, they got this off. It was with their Falcon 9 spacecraft sending a Dragon spaceship to the International Space Station. But what made this special was the rocket, the Falcon 9, the first stage, it has two stages, right? First stage gets you to upper atmosphere. Second stage separates, goes into orbit, sends the payload. The first stage had landing gear on it. Actually had these struts on there designed to stabilize it and allow it to land after it takes off. They would take off. It would do two burns, one to slow it down as it came back towards the Earth and another burn as it got closer towards the surface. They did a previous experiment with this on a prior launch. And coming back into the Earth's atmosphere, it went into some sort of spin because of the fuel sloshing around, whatever. They made modifications to it. This time, they've added the struts to stabilize it. And the problem is like, they're trying to land it in the ocean. The goal is just to try to bring this down in a controlled descent into the ocean. Now, there was rough weather at Canaveral. The seas were pretty choppy. They weren't able to get the support boats out there close enough to where it was supposed to go down, but they were able to get telemetry data. So data from the first stage as it came back down, it was sending information, and as far as they could tell, didn't destabilize, it didn't spin, and they had a full 8 minutes of telemetry data after it landed, after it hit the ocean, which means that it probably survived, reached the ocean intact, and it slowed down, and it did everything they wanted to do on that mission. It was exciting. Now, to give you an idea what that means is, instead of having the rocket crash into the ground or crash into the water, the rocket did a propulsive landing into the ocean and then just sank.
So basically, it tried what they tried to do. Eventually, the dream is to get each of the stages to land Buck Rogers style, you know, like vertically land on the launch pad. But they're like, okay, normally we would just dump these in the ocean. Instead, let's at least try to land them peaceably. So theoretically, the fact that it survived that long says that maybe it landed on there. I guess I'm surprised. Like, nobody was there. Nobody was watching.
Well, it's a pretty big area of which it's going to come down in, and they had rough seas and bad weather.
Okay.
And so that was, you know, the problem. You don't want to put people right under it where it's coming down. If you have a window of how far away you think it's going to be, they're still testing the technology. Now, they do plan, they hope, they would like to some point this year try to land a stage, maybe on land this year, and see about reusing it. Because the first step is just getting this thing back to Earth in one piece, which is already what they've been able to do. Nobody's ever done that before. Nobody has ever done this before, landed a first stage propulsively on the Earth, the surface of the Earth. That's a huge achievement. The next step is for SpaceX is to land it on land at some point and then see how much of it's reusable, to see how quickly they could turn it around. So they would like to be able to do that, turn one around like next year.
All right, questions from the space-interested layman. Is this the last we are going to hear about this particular launch, or are we waiting to see that are they trying to recover that rocket and get information from it, or what is, you know, it's just we're looking forward to the next SpaceX launch when they try to see what they've learned from here to do the next stage, the next stage.
I don't know. I think they may be trying to do some sort of – they had ships to try to do recovery. It's Sunday, so – I don't know what they anticipate. I don't know how deep the water is or what they would expect the likelihood of being able to get it up, but I imagine there might be some recovery effort. We'll probably hear a little bit more. But as far as mission data, this was very, very good. The purpose of those landing legs on there was, one, to make sure the rocket could take off of them, which it did, and then to see if that first stage, if it would stabilize and overcome the problem they had on the last one.
Yeah, which is, I mean, by all accounts from what SpaceX is telling everybody, it was a step forward from where they understood it before. Now, I was on the Padres Corner program there on the Twit Network. That's Padre Father Robert Ballesser. And this was on Friday. We were talking about this very launch. And he made the point that, understand, this is very, very exciting, but let's cool our heels on this a little bit, because materially, even if we land a rocket, we still have to take them apart and put them back together, and that this is not quite spaceship level, land it, refuel it, take it off again.
Well, I mean, not what we've seen so far, but certainly that's the goal, isn't it, right? The fact that it would land it, refuel it, the ability to, you know, keep going back easily.
It's the whole purpose of it. It's called the Falcon 9R. The R stands for reusability because they're building the idea of reusability into the system. That is the that right now they want to find out what condition is it in when it comes back down. And that's they need to know what's working, what's not working. But, yeah, of course. And, yeah, I mean, no disrespect to Father Padre, but no, duh. That's the whole point of this is to see what's reusable after this comes back down and to bring it back in a very reusable condition. Remember, they do – when you put a rocket on a launch pad, you do test firings, do things like that. These aren't like Estes model rocket engines, and it's not like space shuttle solid rocket boosters, which are basically just car tires and peroxide. I mean, these things are reusable engines that are tested numerous times before the rocket, you know, sends something up into space. Now the question is to see how reusable is it after it comes back down. The problem we've had before – is when you drop things into the ocean, you have saltwater corrosion, you have all these other things. But when you can land it on land, you know, we'll find out. And again, that is the question, but that is why it's exciting, because that is what they are trying to find out.
Because we are very close to getting definitive and not theoretical answers. Obviously.
Exactly, exactly.
So tell me, which are you guys genuinely more personally excited about? The advances, and it looks like we're going to see significant advances in both in the next, like, 3 to 5 years. So let's say 5 years from now, two things are possible, and let's give the benefit of the doubt. Let's say, number one, reusable three-stage rockets are a thing.
Two-stage.
And wait, is it two-stage or three-stage?
Falcon's a two-stage.
Two-stage, sorry. Two-stage rockets are a thing. And also 100% autonomous self-driving cars are a thing. Which one, and so basically Google versus SpaceX, which of those two are you more excited about? And I would imagine for different reasons, because I would imagine, like, for me personally, in my life, I'm much, much more excited about self-driving cars because that means a lot to me in the short term. But I'm much more excited for humanity over the three-stage or two-stage rocket.
I'll go first on that. I think that self-driving cars are exciting, and Google's doing all sorts of exciting same things too. We don't even know what some of their black op, what are their secret projects are too. And if SpaceX does this, a lot of other people are going to want to do this. And as far as self-driving cars, I think I would feel the personal impact immediately, but, you know, take a look at air travel. If you never fly on an airplane, you certainly benefit from air travel. FedEx, UPS, the way the world functions has an immediate effect on that. I think we would see the personal benefits of self-driving cars right away. Reusable rockets and the booming space industry would be a little bit further out, but that will have the biggest overall effect on the long term. You know, by the time I'm 100, the self-driving cars will be cool, but what happens to space travel, et cetera, is going to be the bigger thing. But I see. I mean, I agree. Like, personally speaking, first year this happens, oh, yeah, it's going to be a self-driving car. But long-term.
Well, and really, what's the runway on a self-driving car before there's something that is commercially available, even in the way that, like, the Tesla, you know, the Roadsters are now, you know, or the Model S, where it is – consumer priced compared to other electric cars, but no matter how much we love Tesla, none of the three of us own it because we're not in the financial strata to buy it. You know, like when do they become something that is revolutionary for us, even on a level where maybe people want to buy a fleet of them, and that's it solves like a public transit, you know, a Uber like kind of you know, service where you're just able to, you know, have a cheaper process to get from point A to point B by paying for it. For me, I'm all about the rocket because that is like that's the humanity game changer. You know, and even like, you know, there's been plans and stuff for years to have rocket based travel between two points on the Earth. You know, like to
right.
You know, get from London
suborbital, you know, point A to point B type thing.
Yeah, and it's like the more that we're looking at cheaper reusable rockets, the more, you know, kind of everything sort of changes on that infrastructure level.
I would say that, like, adding to Brian's point, though, I think that if we add in what Google's trying to do with robotics, et cetera, and, you know, like you mentioned, like, you know, if the first, our first contact with self-driving cars is a Uber-type thing, that's exciting. Product delivery, the idea of what kind of that Google vision of how much can we automate the moving of bits. And now I read a pretty good article about Google has this initiative called Google X, which is where they're trying to develop their pie-in-the-sky technologies, which is where self-driving cars came out of whatever. And they, the way they describe it says Google X is about bits. Where Google's about bytes, Google X is about bits and moving atoms or doing things with physical things. And, you know, they've been acquiring all these robotics companies, and we will live in, you know, we could live in a radically, 10 years from now might be radically different than where we think we're headed right now because some of these things come into fruition.
Well, and keep in mind also, like Justin just asked, like, well, really, how far off are commercially available self-driving cars? The answer is 4 months ago. The world's first commercially available self-driving car launched at CES. So it's like it's right around the corner. Well, this crap is happening right now.
On a level that matters to us. And there's also a million things that get launched at CES that, you know, aren't really launched, you know, or are more vaporware than they are.
Well, I'll say this much. I caught my first ever Tesla in the wild in East Austin last week for the first time. Just at a traffic stop, I looked over and saw a full-on Tesla Model S over there. So it's like, I mean, I think all of that stuff is happening right now. And I know you meant it as a, you know, a technically real but still ethereal to the common man thing with the Tesla, but I think that's I think we're closer to it than you would imagine.
Dude, right there. Listen, you just saw a Tesla in East Austin. Like, I live amongst them. Like, I see them like on several per week, especially if I'm doing stuff in Mountain View, Palo Alto.
I see every day. I mean, yeah, where I live, I see them every day.
Yeah. So it's like, it's not that I guess it's like, but we had a run up to that, you know, and we are yet to see Tesla's full impact or the full impact of that version of electric car, be it Tesla or somebody else. I mean, you know, you see Volts and stuff like that. And granted, those aren't the same kind of idea that Tesla's doing in terms of making them financially viable. But, I think it's real. I just wonder what the real world, like at what point when we all need new cars. Right, the three of us, do we look at it and say, yeah, no, definitely, the Tesla's just the way to go because it makes more sense for me to do it.
I think for the self-driving, the biggest hurdle, of course, is going to be the legislative. I mean, after the technology is there, you're going to have this hesitation and this fear, and you're going to have, you know, the companies that don't make self-driving cars who fear losing fleet sales, et cetera, are going to put up a protest over it, and we'll see. But I'm going to change the topic. Back to space for a moment. And I don't know if this thing escaped my attention at the time. Maybe you guys saw this, but a few years ago, some NASA scientists decided to send up a balloon to about 120,000 feet up, which is pretty friggin' high. And their goal was to search the sky for heat from the first generation of stars. So it was like a really high altitude observatory system or high altitude sensor to try to detect heat from the formation of the earliest stars to peer back across the universe back to the earliest star formation. They turned on their system, they listened in, and instead of the faint signal we hoped to find, said one of the researchers, here was this booming noise 6 times louder than anyone had predicted. Detailed analysis ruled out an origin from primordial stars or from known radio sources, including gas in the outermost halo of our own galaxy. The source of this cosmic radio background remains a mystery. It is called space roar.
Okay, hold on. Walk me through this again. So first of all, this is not from an actual star. This is from just a section that is unknown to be occupied and what appears to be a bolt out of the blue from the cosmic background radiation.
This is coming from all over.
Okay.
Coming from all over. And so we wanted to try to listen in for, you know, to look for like just the heat signatures of forming stars, but it was that information was overwhelmed by the signal 6 times louder than what would be predicted to come from these sources. So we have yet to explain this according to my Wikipedia research.
Hmm. So and when did this happen? How long was it?
Well, the initial thing was they made the announcement in 2009. It was based upon an earlier study they did. They finally came forward in 2009 and said this. In 2011, the project's called Arcade. Arcade 2 research is reported correcting for instrumental systematic errors in measurements such as Arcade 2 is always our primary concern. We emphasize that we detect residual emission at 3 GHz with Arcade 2 data, but the result is also independently detected by a combination of low-frequency data and some other jargon. So basically, they've continuously report this background roar. We don't know what it is.
Man, okay, I guess, and again, I'm trying to wrap my mind around, like, the reason it's 6 times louder than what they had previously seen in the background radiation, and I assume...
No, why don't we see what we would expect? We never detected it this, we never looked with this precision before.
I see, okay. So it's not like a spike in volume over a period of time. It's like we did the math, and what we're getting is 6 times bigger than the math said should be there.
That is correct.
Okay, all right, that makes more sense. Wow.
So,
space roar. Wait, what did you say?
Space roar, which just sounds like such a metal album name, by the way.
Oh, my God. Are you kidding? It's like form a band just based on that name.
So, I mean, we don't know what it is?
Do we have
usual suspects? Like, can we round them up and question them? Like, what the hell do we, I mean, what are the theories?
There really aren't many theories at this point. It's anything that we would have think that would give off this radiation or this noise wouldn't. I mean, there's it's too loud for any of our usual suspects. And as far as to theories to what it is, there really are no current theories as of my reading of this.
Can we come up with some
responsible
theories?
Sure. Dial tone of the internet of the universe.
Yes, and it sounds like a bee, dee, dee, dee. This is like its own little science fiction story, right? Like this is like we hear this is almost like the ominous dial tone that starts our story forward is this this space roar.
Okay, so let's wrap our minds around. Let's do some crazy talking. Let's do some weird things thinking here. Like if you are I forget which the different types of civilizations are according to Michio Kaku. You know let's say you're the best one, the one that could control and harvest the entire energy of suns or whatever. If you wanted to get word out, is there any way to encode a signal in this kind of thing? I mean, I guess not, since by very nature the background radiation is what's left over from the Big Bang, and by definition you occurred and developed after the Big Bang, so there's no way for you to affect the noise coming from all directions outside.
Well, I mean, I don't know that this has necessarily had to begin at the Big Bang. It seems to be something that's all around us. And we're now finding out, too, that life could have been possible much, much earlier on in our universe than we previously thought. So I'm not going to rule out aliens.
Okay.
So if this were an alien form of communication, who would be the ones to decode? Like, is this publicly available? Is some Randy Quaid crackpot going to figure this out and start screaming and yelling on the streets of New York?
But, I mean, is it... We don't have to assume that it's necessarily communication either. You know, if what does it sound like in the middle of a Google server farm?
Right. Oh, wow. So you're saying, like, what if this is like a cosmic – what if this is like a copy of a cosmic Wikipedia that's been put out into the stars and just meant for everyone to discover and decode?
Well, I'm not even saying that. I'm literally saying what would it sound like if you were inside of a Google server
farm?
This is
just the output. This is just the
fan noise
of this thing that is – existing.
We've talked about before about how the old kind of idea of like if we were going to look for intelligent life, we sort of tend to think of kind of 19th century sort of ideas, footprints on the moon or massive colonies or these other things. But a sufficiently advanced civilization is going to use radically different forms of technology than we're capable of. We've talked about Pico technology, the idea of actually building computers inside entire atoms and et cetera, and the idea of you kind of getting smaller, 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 smaller to the point you don't even see it Is there noise? Is there background radiation? Is there the sound? Is that the sound of some ascended supergalactic civilization?
Is this the sound of Galactus's tummy rumbling and our Earth is about to become lunch?
Totally valid.
I'll tell you what, like, I think about the Fermi paradox. And for those of you who don't know, like, Enrico Fermi tackling the idea of alien civilizations basically said, okay, yes, if the numbers work out that there's bazillions of different civilizations out there, how come we haven't seen any of them or seen indications of any of them? But then I think about it coupled with the fact that, you know, for a good, 150 years or so, Earth was really great at putting out loud analog signals and then all of a sudden we went digital. And essentially, if you're on the outside of Earth, all of a sudden in the last 10 years, we've gone totally radio silent. Like we're still putting out noise, but it's not any kind of noise you can distinguish or decode, or it's all encrypted and digital and blah, 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 blah. And it makes me wonder, it almost seems like the digital revolution has provided an answer to the Fermi paradox. Like maybe they are still out there. They're just not, you know, maybe it was 50 years ago we were egotistical to wonder if they should have been using, you know, analog NTSC, you know, video technology or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the Fermi paradox, it was like from 1950 when this sort of was conjectured, and the idea at which we would see technology and computational technology accelerate in the 60 plus years since, I think it would have been hard for anybody to have foreseen the idea that, you know, you look at in 1950, you know, a computer was still a massive, giant, room sized thing.
Well, and also only peripherally useful as well. You know, computers weren't how things got done.
Frequency hopping was, you know, maybe 6 or 7 years old of an idea and not really put into much of a practical application. And so I think that, you know, had he lived another 20 or 30 years, he may have rethought and said, oh, you know, then there can be many different ways that technology can evolve and shape us. Space war.
Man, space war. Yeah, it's so weird to think of the idea that, like, just because of the, like, untravelable distances that would have to be between us and you know, any other kind of life, theoretically, that, like, you know, we dream about it and we want it to be true, and we've conceptualized it on some kind of level, be it right or wrong, on what that means for us to come in contact with outside life or what they would be, that, like, I just kind of wonder if on this level, like, were we dreaming in a pre-transatlantic boat, before the first transatlantic, you know, boat journey, we're, you know, looking at where other, you know, other beings on other continents were effectively the same as beings on other planets. Like, you know, did we dream about that there was these things out there, that there was life outside of our cities and towns, you know, or kingdoms? Like, I wonder how much there was, you know, that same level of thinking.
True.
Yeah. Man, just hearing you talk about intercontinental relations, like, in the 20th century, I'm really struck by how different everything is after the internet. I mean, think about just the last 15 years. In an age where in Reddit somebody can post a story about an Indian tribe that does whatever, and within 20 minutes, you could bet that the number one most upvoted comment will be a guy who grew up in that tribe who now is an electrical engineer in, you know, in New Delhi or wherever. I don't know. It's really astonishing to me to realize how starkly, just 100 years ago, just last century, our grandparents and great-grandparents regarded other people as like another species, and how dead that is right now. How deeply, even now, like, as our political overlords try to make Iran into, you know, the next USSR, and how dead those words feel, and how they just fall flat, because meanwhile we're seeing tweets and messages from the actual people on the other side. But I guess what I'm saying is, I wonder if the internet isn't the death of the othering of other, you know, socio-political strata.
Well, that brings me to my next topic here, gentlemen.
Oh, yes, good.
So I like going on these sort of tangents, as I think we all do, these sort of little research tangents and then thoughts and ideas. And one of the things that's radically changing our view of history is history is communicated to us by the stories people tell, by the writings we find, by the things we find in the ground. And often enough, the only thing we really have are the little fragments that we find. And if something wasn't recorded or isn't found, it's hard to know what really took place. But a big radical thing happened in the last decade or so, and that's been using genetics to try to tell the story of history and looking into our own genes and to find out how interrelated or how connected we really are, which is surprising because you find out that, you know, we're much more closely related in many ways than we would have expected. And things that we never we thought didn't happen turned out to happen. I'll give you, you know, one of the examples is the Viking exploration of America. It's well accepted now. People know that the Vikings came to North America 1,000 years ago, they were 500 years before Columbus came here. They visited, of course, you know, tens of thousands of years after the Native Americans came to America. But the Vikings had explored America, and it wasn't just this one-time touch-the-ground-and-leave kind of thing. They had colonies for extended periods of time, and even after those colonies, they stopped doing those colonies, they would come back, they would go look for timber, they would exchange, they would get in battles with the not a very, for the most part, friendly relationship with the Native Americans, the Skraelings that they called them. Sometimes it was, but there was trading going on, and so the Vikings were actively trading with North America, had involved in that, and then probably due to climate getting a bit colder and a little bit more inhospitable in those areas, they retreated from there. When we look at the accounts of what took, and by the way, this was something that wasn't really accepted, you know, in the Middle Ages. And, you know, Columbus's time, nobody realized that, you know, they knew the stories the Vikings told about going to somewhere off place, but nobody really believed they went to this whole new world, and that's why it was such
Vikings,
a big thing.
Well, have been telling stories about going to Asgard for all anyone else cared.
Exactly. Now, I was curious about something, because I wondered, you know, knowing now that we have a much more bigger picture of like the Vikings coming here, a lot more evidence of it, and it was over hundreds of years and not just one or two attempts. I'm thinking like, man, you know, one of the things that's happened whenever you read stories about people going to visit some other group of people, they tend to bring people back with them.
Yeah.
Right? You know, Columbus would bring back, hey, look what we found, and maybe either to make slaves or to do whatever. And the slave trade, by the way, is fascinating because it didn't just all go out of Africa to Europe. You had people going from Muslim countries going up into Europe and raiding villages there and taking people down and all over. It was just a cross-cultural thing. It wasn't always necessarily slaves. Sometimes you'd have people ships would come aboard, they'd come to a place. They'd be shorthanded. You're some young guy in a village. Your prospects aren't good. Maybe you'll hop on board and find your way there. So the question I always wondered was, did we ever have any evidence of Native Americans coming from the Americas to Europe in pre-Columbian times?
Oh, wow. Holy cow. This is a question I've never heard before. The idea that, because you would think, I mean, there's certainly nothing to stop them. The fact that they could skip from area, you know, from island to island, you know, one way. If the Vikings could do it, why couldn't the Native Americans?
Well, they didn't have the ships to do it. That'd be the problem.
But they'd go back with the Vikings.
They'd go back with the Vikings. So a genetic study of some people in Iceland, which is a European country in a period of time was a, you know, territory of Norway, Denmark, etc., found DNA.
No way.
That is apparently Native American DNA. Now, the tribe that this DNA belonged to no longer exists, but a number of them have gone extinct, but they found them, and they traced using degradation. They could tell that this was most likely pre-Columbian, that this DNA came to Iceland before we had opened up, you know, the Americas. And it's a mitochondrial, so it came from a female, so it's likely that we took a woman or women from the Americas and brought them to Iceland, and they became mothers and had children that then had children and children. And to this day, there are people in Iceland with Native American DNA that came from pre-Columbian contact. And there's no reason to say that some of them did not then go back from Iceland then to the continent and spread it even for, you know, within 100 years, several hundred years prior to Columbus, could have then brought it to Europe.
Okay, wow. Number one, hooray for science, right? Mm-hmm. But number two, boo for the objectification of women as the spoils of exploration?
Probably wasn't willingly, but
I mean I don't know. It's through a different lens is all I'm saying.
Well, and also it's like this is kind of, you know, the particulars certainly have I think softened as we have become a more enlightened society. But the idea of these kind of far from home situations where you breed with the natives of the land that you are at, that happens all the time. You know, that happens in wars that happen in the modern era.
Getting past the circumstance of which we do not know, and you know, slave trading culture was active in the Americas as well, and it's often enough you find that these people, not that it makes it right, but it's going from a place of bad to another place of bad, and it's not like necessarily. Anyhow, my point is that this is, here we have the first evidence of European Native America commingling the DNA and coming to Europe prior to Columbus, which is fascinating.
That's crazy. When you lay it out like that, it all makes sense. Like, these are all situations that we know exist. You know, we all know that these things happen, but it is kind of wild to think that, like, yeah, that was an element of the Americas that had made it across to Europe before anything else.
Well, I guess another point is that the thing was that if you brought up this idea 10 years ago or so, it would have been largely debunked, because they'd say, no, there are no accounts of this. There are no accounts of this when you read, you know, the descriptions of the voyages, et cetera. Nobody ever talked about this happening. Didn't happen. The DNA says otherwise, and I will go with the DNA over the idea that maybe not every voyage was described. Not every adventure was, you know, put into some form of writing we knew about. And this shows us there is so much more history that we don't know.
Man, yes, a million times yes. Plus also, like it's amazing how much has happened in the last 20 years of my life as far as understanding how dumb every human being on the planet is and how poor we are at recognizing or remembering the past.
Compared to what?
Well, I mean, but that compared to like DNA records is what I'm saying. It's like all of history, everything you and I learned when we were 10 years old was built in an era when we believed what our elders told us and what our elders wrote down. And it turns out that the science says that virtually all of that is wrong. And now that we're like taking a forensic view of history, I love it because we're getting closer to the actual truth, which makes so much more sense than what, you know, nonsense was reported.
I think that there's, you know, there was an idea that we had a pretty concrete idea of the past and the rest was just filling in some minor details. And genetics has certainly showed us that. And there, it's come to a head with many people, traditional historians, because they say, well, our history says this point. And then you'll have things where you look for artifacts. And you'll say, we found these artifacts for this culture here. There's no evidence of this other culture being here. But the geneticists say, yeah, but we found their genes. And, you know, you can't, you know, I would say, you know, you have to, of course, weigh the genetic evidence with the appropriate amount of how likely it is to be true or whatever. But I tend to lean towards the genetic evidence. It was like, you know, we've talked about this before. There's a group of Ethiopians that claim that they were like a lost tribe of Israel. And, you know, people are like, well, you don't look Jewish to me because they look, you know, traditionally Ethiopian. And with some differences. And then finally, you know, it was kind of like, yeah, sure, you guys are a lost, you're lost Israelites, sure. And then genetically they looked at them and they said, oh, guess what? They are.
Yeah. And it's crazy to think of history as just, like, in the metaphor of how we've looked at, like, television, right? You know, or screens or pictures or something that, you know, that we like the idea of a scratchy black and white picture as like, this is the best we've ever had. This is great. And then, you know, but every step forward, the picture sharpens. We get better resolution. We understand more about everything in terms of the depth and shadows that oftentimes really tell the tale instead of just this very basic idea that we've done. And it's admirable that we've always done our best to find out what everything was. But at the same time, me and Brian joked on the first Night Attack album that like, would you be shocked if all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, by the way, Abe Lincoln was Asian. We just never, nobody ever got around to, you know, coming up with that. But as it turns out, what do you know? That really, everybody we think is Abe Lincoln wasn't Abe Lincoln. Is this other dude, and he was Asian.
There's interesting evidence, too, that there might be a village in China that has Roman ancestors. There's it's fascinating. And speaking of it, just as given that it's Easter Sunday, and for our friends who are celebrate out there, little interesting thing about the idea of culture diffusion, how things change. I sent an article to Justin today talking about the growth of the Christian population in China. There are...
No, hold on. When you say growth of the Christian population, do you mean like the growth of Christianity as a popular religion in China, or do you mean like those people multiplying at a faster rate?
Both.
All right.
But more people adopting it. From the Telegraph, it came a study that said that predicts that by... think 2025 to 2030, by 2030, China will have the world's largest Christian population.
Wait, run that by me again?
By 2030, China will have the world's largest Christian population.
Wow.
Man. Right now, there's something like 70 million Christians in China.
That's, so, and that way, I assume that's practically as many, or almost as many Christians in the United States, right?
About 230 million in the United States, but...
No, well, okay, hold on. Wait, you're out of 300 million, we have 230, like 80%, 70% of our...
identify as Christian or Catholic, yeah.
All right.
You know, yeah. Listen, man, just because we're in our little bubble...
Yeah, because we're in our
We have surrounded ourselves with like-minded people, and the way that humanity.
I would have figured like what, 7% Jewish, I don't know, 4% Muslim, and I don't know, like 10%. No, I guess that is right.
Yeah. Well, I guess the bigger question is, you know, where does this put – because you've always heard of Islam being a very, you know, rapidly spreading religion. Does this is Christianity – I guess I've never really, like, taken a look at the hard numbers. Who's winning the race between Christianity and Islam and expanding to the to the folks who don't – the untapped markets?
I my guess would probably be like groups identify as Christian. You have Islam has, you know, of course, Middle East. It has a spread in North Africa and then parts of Asia. You take places like Indonesia, et cetera, like that. But, you know, as you look at as a global, you know, all of Latin America, you know, most of, you know, Mexico, United States, Canada. And then there you have places in Africa that have, you know, 100 million, you know, Christians too. There are a number of African countries that are identified as Christian too. So, you know, I haven't done the tally yet, but it is fascinating though to see, you know, the spread of, you know, these two Middle Eastern sort of belief systems as they work their way around the world. So,
what do you think that this means for, you know, China-U.S. relations culturally? Is this a good sign for, you know, the closeness of the American and Chinese populace if we have at least one growing thing that we increasingly get along about?
I think that it can be – I certainly think that when you can find areas of which you agree, it can be helpful. You know, we could argue the merits of, you know, a belief system and to what degree you take it over excluding other people and values and stuff. I think it might be too early to tell, you know, I don't know if they're going to be, you know, are they going to be, you know, a very narrow view of it, a large view of it, whatever, but I think that it will introduce problems if there begin to be crackdowns, which Chinese government, again, has a number of these churches are underground churches. They do have some Chinese mega churches, but the government is suspicious of any other power institution there that can threaten it. And they've cracked down hard on things like Qigong, and sometimes for legitimate reasons, that becomes a big threat. And that's how will we react here as a predominantly Christian country if all of a sudden there's a crackdown on Christians in China?
What do you think religion will look like 100, 200 years from now? And this, I don't know, I apologize if this is offensive, Danny, or whatever, but like we've seen the way Catholicism has evolved to, for example, let's take Christmas, right? Christmas is a ritual that is beloved by all Christians that celebrates the birth of, baby Jesus or whatever. It very likely involves, the gift giving at the winter solstice predates it. The tree decorations is a, Germanic tribal tradition. Also, Jesus wasn't born in the winter. It was in the summer or whatever. The point is whatever Christmas is, it has evolved as a mishmash, and on top of that, you got St. Nicholas, Sinterklaas and so on, all these weird theoretical mashups that become, Santa Claus as we know him on the Coca-Cola bottle. Like, knowing that religion and culture and tradition is malleable, not in the short term, but certainly in the long term, what do you think religion is going to look like 100, 200 years from now? Do you think we're going to mash up Taoism and Buddhism and Islam or Islamic philosophy and Judaism and Christianity into some kind of like meta thing that's going to become universally popular?
I mean, if you look at Christianity and Islam, it already is a like you mentioned, a homogenization of other stuff. Do I think that we are moving toward a mono religion? No. Like, I think that any idea that survives an organization on whatever level, especially something as centralized as the Catholic Church, I personally would take a wild guess. And again, this is just a barking idiot in Oakland, but I don't think that it survives without evolution on some level, in terms of making sure that it is a relevant message for its populace. But I don't know. I don't know what we can, rationally expect beyond that. A lot of these ideas, seem to, monotheistic religions stick for a reason,
I think religion is inherently pragmatic and adapts to the circumstances. The Islam practiced in Pakistan is very, very different than the form of Islam you're going to find practiced in metropolitan Turkey or Indonesia or that. In Christianity, a Protestant church today, if you went back 100 years ago and intermingled with somebody in a Protestant church, you're going to find a very different value set than they had before. And, we can look at the data and show that arguably we have become more moral individuals over time, which is, every time we bring this up, people have a lot of difficulty accepting this. But if you look at crime versus, crimes against other people, murder, theft, rape, all these things, they have radically been declining over the last several thousand years. And as religiosity has, declined, there's actually been a decline in these other things. And I don't, there's a relationship between the two, but I think that you're going to have religion's going to fill the need that people have. People who have a spiritual need are going to gravitate towards it. People who get comfort or solace from it are going to want to do it. People who find a value, people who want a value system that is clearly defined for them are going to go towards that. What that value system will be what will be conducive to surviving in a civilization 100 years from now.
Well, okay, the reason I bring it up is because, like, as few as 50 years ago, it was a big deal. And again, I'm taking all of this from crap I heard secondhand from listening to Ben Gillette's, podcast or whatever. But one of the things he talked about, and that Glenn Beck didn't believe until he had his, interns look it up or whatever, was that 50, 60 years ago, there was no concept of universal Christianity. There was no, I identify as a Christian or whatever. You identified as a Lutheran, as a Methodist, mm-hmm. as a Baptist, as a Catholic or whatever. And you always hated the other tribe, right? But then when Kennedy went, ran for president, it became like, well, I'm a Christian, just like all of you guys. And this idea that all of a sudden we're all in the same clubhouse was what permeated America. And I wonder, like knowing that Islam and Judaism and Christianity are three branches off the same tree. They all hold the Old Testament as their original value. Like, I wonder if there won't be this kind of like, well, we all worship the same God, you know, and like a folding in that regard. That's what I'm wondering.
I guess the devil's in the details, though. And I think that how a Mormon practices and how a Catholic practices, and if you follow them around 7 days a week, aren't going to be radically different in many ways. And I would say that's true of, like, I think, you know, people practice Islam outside of, like, you know, the traditional sort of Middle East, it could be different. But as far as, I don't know. I think that it comes down to the thing that I would say is that modern Christianity has a very strong humanistic ethic, or, you know, humanistic qualities in a good way that is not necessarily evident in, let's say, forms of Islam practice in certain places. And I think that if you embrace the humanistic side of it, it could be possible. But, you know, when you have popular Islamic groups that their sole purpose is, you know, Islamic groups in, let's say, Africa, that go into and raid schools and pull girls out of schools to prevent them from being westernized, when you have this sort of anti-humanist ideals that are supported, that's the problem. When Lutherans, Catholics, people of, you know, Jewish faith, and I would say modernized Islamic people could say, hey, no, we're family focused, we're people first, we support these ideas, there's a lot of room and commonality. I mean, that's why, you know, somebody who's, you know, American Muslims can be radically different from somebody, you know, second or third generation American Muslims, a very different person than somebody who's living in, you know, Pakistan.
Right.
So,
and I mean, you're seeing on certain levels, I mean, like the idea that, like, interfaith elements, you know, and values kind of exist, and conferences that there is something of value to bringing in other people who, you know, are generally monotheistic religions, you know, like that. That does exist, you know. There are those values, but I guess the question is, especially in terms of the Catholic Kennedy example, is you kind of have to have a reason why that would be. There would be a push for it, and the society is ready for it to be pushed for. You know, the reason why. I mean, like, Kennedy might have been the catalyst on that idea, especially being politically viable, because it brought together a larger voting block of people, and it turned famously, I mean, one of the more famous elements of political strategy to take the greatest negative about Kennedy as a candidate, in that he would be getting calls from the Pope and running, you know, the White House by way of Rome, and turned it into a gigantic positive of, like, yes, I'm not ashamed of my religion, and neither are you, and isn't that great? You know, I guess we would have to find out where, you know, where it would benefit everybody, yeah, to link together.
And to try to, like, I guess simply what I was trying to say or articulate slightly better is, I think that when the cultural differences aren't as significant, and you have, you know, if you're Jewish and American, you know, you can have a history of being here for 100 years, and it's sort of, it's just a thing. If you're Hasidic and you have to follow certain practices that tend to isolate you from even mainstream Jewish people, that's going to always be that sort of the concept of the other, you know, the style of dress, the style of behavior, et cetera, which makes it harder to assimilate, and because your goal is not to. Same as the Amish, same as some of these, you know, fringe Christian groups that, you know, spun off a couple hundred years ago, which have these, their practices make them different. And, you know, I have friends who are Muslim American who, like, I had no idea that they were practicing Muslim, because culturally speaking, they were just like everybody else I knew. Women didn't wear burqas, you know, didn't have to subscribe to the same practices that people that are much, much more, you know, practicing a much more stricter form of it. So I think that it's when you are able to sort of normalize with other people, then it becomes inclusive.
Yeah, well, the good news is, if there's one thing philosophers for 2,000 years have showed us, is that there's no way we're going to settle this on the Weird Things podcast. So
And there's no way that three atheists are going to decide the future of monotheistic religions on a large scale.
So I say we move on to pigs.
You're welcome, Christians, Jews, and Muslims. We solved it for you. Happy Easter.
Gentlemen, let's do some pigs.
Oh, man. Just real quick. Just for anybody who is religious, like, we do understand how ridiculous it is. And we do none of it. This has all just been complete, like, theoretical conjecture between the three of us. Because I do understand how annoying it is when there are people who are outside. It's not even their thing, but it's like, well, we'll solve it. We'll figure it out.
I don't think we're trying to solve anything. The question was, what do I think it'll be like 100 years from now? And I think
the question is, where are the trends headed?
Having been raised in a religious environment, I have religious friends, I feel qualified as anybody else to interject my thoughts on where things might go.
I understand that. And I think that there's a reason why in good faith, we had that conversation, you know, because I think we are all kind of the same mind when it comes to it.
My answer wasn't, well, everybody's going to think like me.
Yeah, I guess that's I want to reiterate, because I know that we understand where we're coming from, and I just wanted to inoculate us from a perception that often kind of, I think, pops up when you don't just get your feelings out on Front Street.
Sure. Look, can we move on to something really important, which is what my newest favorite sci-fi book is in the world right now?
Yeah, let's go.
What is it?
Justin knows, but do you know?
Keep talking. I'm gonna come
all
in with the
question. All right, I'm gonna keep talking. Andrew, do you know what my new favorite sci-fi book is?
Not a clue.
Oh my God! It is The Martian.
Oh yes.
Holy cow! Did I love this book? This was. Do you remember our argument about? You know, my theory was like send someone to go up and die on Mars or whatever. This is the closest to that scenario in the most scientific-minded, plausible situation I ever could have dared hope for. And plus, it's written in a voice that I absolutely adore. If you're a fan of John Scalzi, if you like Ready Player One, you're going to enjoy the voice of this book. The opening line is a log from a man who got abandoned on Mars on the third Mars mission. The idea is the rest of the crew thought he died because there was a windstorm and some equipment like hit him and stabbed him, and his suit telemetry showed depressurization, and they're like, well, the guy's clearly dead, and so they left, right? What happened was he got stabbed, and yes, the suit did depressurize, but he bled and it coagulated and formed kind of a loose seal, and it was enough to where he was able to wake up and realize that his entire team had left him, and that he was alone on Mars. And the opening line, and forgive me, we're gonna curse. You know what? I won't curse. The opening line is, "Well, I'm pretty much effed." Only he doesn't say F. And he breaks down the entire cascade of errors that brought him to this moment where all of a sudden he's abandoned alone on Mars. And then the next chapter he realizes, well, I do have, you know, food for five people that was meant for 3 months. That'll get me to, like, I don't know, 2 years. The next mission is supposed to land here 3-4 years from now. Crap, what do I got? And he looks around and he thinks, he's like, oh, son of a bitch, I'm a biologist, and they wanted us to have potatoes at Thanksgiving. So I have a living potato. And so he cuts up the potato and makes sprigs and starts farming and starts trying to survive. His game being, you know, it's a down to the wire question of whether or not he will survive long enough for help to arrive. And it is utterly engaging. I loved it from beginning to end. It engaged me from the beginning. It was a hair trigger end. Loved everything about this book. Everybody on the planet, the guy who reads the audiobook is amazing. Go to Audible and sign up and read The Martian. What do you say, Justin?
Well, now let's get to the funny story. So you love The Martian. You just get done listening to it, or maybe you're still reading it, and you tweet out that your favorite science fiction book experience is The Martian, written by Andy Weir. I am going to meet that night, like this is hours after you tweeted it, I'm going to meet Tom Merritt because he's in town to do a Sword and Laser thing, and we were going to record FSL afterward. So I go meet him, and unbeknownst to me, he is there because he's interviewing a couple authors for a San Francisco book club.
Yes.
One of those authors is Andy Weir, who I see these books that are like up there because he's doing a Q&A with The Martian on it. I'm like, oh, that's the book that Brian was screaming and yelling about on Twitter. And he's like, oh my God, we gotta rib him. We gotta figure out a way to screw with him. So Tom takes this picture of me and Andy Weir and me giving Brian the middle finger while Veronica photobombs in the background.
By the way, Veronica photobombing in the background is my favorite thing because neither you nor me mentioned it at all. Whereas like, oh, look, you're giving me the finger because I love this book and you're with the author giving me the finger. And then and putting it out and seeing all of Twitter go like, nice photobomb, Veronica, was amazing.
Yeah, that was amazing. But yeah, so that was – and actually – it was the first time that I had ever been to an author Q&A, a sci-fi author Q&A. Now, I haven't read The Martian, but I look forward to reading it or listening to it on Audible. But it was the first sci-fi Q&A where I came out liking both of the authors afterward. Very, very rarely do I listen to sci-fi author Q&As and tend to not think of them a little bit more blowhardy than I did going in. But these guys were both super awesome. It was the dude who did Demon
and Freedom Trademark. And in fact, I'm actually reading right now his latest Influx. His name's Daniel Suarez.
That's it.
He was a fan of our Diamond Club experiment.
But yeah, oh, that's awesome. No, so yeah, it was Daniel Suarez and Andy Weir. They were both really awesome. And go ahead, everybody, go read The Martian.
There it is right there, Influx. That's
and I was hanging. I was chilling with Andy Weir and flicking off Brian. Like, which was very, very – anytime that I can harass Brian in a more personal and hilarious and larger scale way is something that makes me happy.
Justin, pick.
I have nothing of any kind of worth to pick, so I'll call my own number on this and let everybody know that the FSL Tonight podcast is coming back, and that means that we have another Kickstarter. So if you – have listened to FSL Tonight in the past, you can go to Kickstarter and just search for FSL. Those are just the letters, FSL. And go and buy yourself some merch. We got T-shirts, pennants, like we did last year, where you're able to pick any two science fiction franchises or fantasy franchises that you want and have me and Tom talk about it. You can get From the Vault old school episodes from the FSL universe. If you are unfamiliar with FSL in general, then it is me and Tom Merritt in the vein of sports talk radio dissecting a league playing an ill-defined sport that is comprised of science fiction and fantasy franchises. Think of it as a way that Star Wars plays against Lord of the Rings and, the Dune universe plays against new entrants this year, the Ponyville Phillies. So the My Little Pony, the Brony universe and fan base comes to the FSL this season. It's super fun. If you like fan fiction, I guess, too. If you like fan fiction and that kind of meta storytelling on top of the elements of these pieces of art that we love so much, then you will enjoy FSL Tonight. And if you are literate in sports talk radio, not even really just sports, but just the conventions of sports talk radio, then you will enjoy it all the more. It is FSL on Kickstarter. Just search for FSL on Kickstarter.com.
Dude, have you thought about doing any kind of like recreations of like old matches from like the 1920s?
That's what we did last time. We did I forget what the names of the teams were, but it was essentially H.G. Wells, the Time Machine, versus Mark Twain's a Connecticut Yankee.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm so happy to hear that. That's awesome.
So that was, I think that was our From the Vault episode. And that only went to Kickstarter backers last year. So we will be doing a similar one for Kickstarter backers this year.
Dude, that's awesome. Hey, can we also drop a quick plug for the fact that you and I have laid eyes upon the unbelievably delightful doodles of our stupid faces as Breaking Bad characters for Geek of Week.
Oh yeah, no, we did our Geek of Week for Night Attack. We did our Geek of Week interview with Len Peralta this week, and he sent us the first sketch. It should be a surprise when it comes out.
It should be a surprise. Right? We won't show it right now, but suffice to say, we were both very flattered and very excited.
It is in the vein of something in pop culture that me and Brian both enjoy a lot, and it was very fun to see the beginning sketches.
Yeah.
Andrew?
Gentlemen, our mention of Islam here has caused a bit of a controversy in the discussion room here. Shocking.
Oh man.
The point is everyone's great and we're all rad and everyone's wonderful.
Yes. There are it's like all religions have a spectrum of people and practitioners and that anybody would take offense was not at all intended at all. And
I would say, I mean, you know, right now in Salt Lake City, the American Atheists are doing their conference out there in Salt Lake City, Utah. Ashley's out there. There are elements of organized atheism that I highly find distasteful and do not
For the record, I don't want to out anyone, but people in this panel have gone on at length about what aspects of atheism and atheists they find utterly distasteful that they can't handle.
And again, there is a spectrum of this, and you know, the problem is, of course, is that you know every group needs to be able to look inwardly and say these are things we need to address. You know, Pakistan should be commended; it had the first female prime minister, something that we have yet to have a female president, which is to certainly say to openness. It still has an abysmally low literacy rate for females, and when you move outside of metropolitan areas into the further areas, it is horrific how women can be treated there because of the feudal system and they have no rights. In the United States, we have issues and problems we need to address too. We have a black president. Did that mean that we got rid of racism? Absolutely not.
No, that's what people voted for. They voted for, we're done with racism, and now we're done with racism.
Yeah, and so these things, these are every group has their issues they have to deal with, and when it comes from looking at the differences, and I would say that was when we talked about everything coming together. I think that the cultural differences on the humanistic side, I think, would be the sort of the biggest differences, and that is the thing. And I also think that, like, you know, the plight of, you know, if you're a practicing Muslim, you know, in a non-Muslim country, is you are treated unfairly with suspicion. You are treated as an outsider, and you have these sort of this attitude around you that can be, you know, it is unfair, and it's something I wouldn't understand it, couldn't comprehend what that would be like. And so I know there tends to be a persecution complex that's often very justified because of this, that we talk about the idea of the other over and over again. So
I've been mistakenly discriminated against as a Muslim. Like I was at a bar and somebody looked at me and did like, oh, la, 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 la. And like, and I was like looking around. I'm like, oh man, I wonder what Muslim he's making fun of. And then I'm like, oh wait, that's me, I guess. And I walked up to him and I'm like, were you just doing that? Like, cause like you thought I was a Muslim? And he was like, yeah. And I'm like, I mean, I'm not. It's kind of screwed up though. And he's like, oh, sorry, man. It's my bad. Like, apologize to me. But like that, like, It's out there, like, and I've only had, because my skin's slightly darker than you know other people's, and I have a beard most of the time. I've gotten it a little bit, enough to understand that, like, if I had to get it all the time, it would get really, really, really annoying.
Yeah, and that's a thing that can only be theoretical, you know, for somebody like myself. And so no offense was meant at all, you know, and we will, you know, as Justin points out, we're very, very happy to criticize, you know, people who of our own ilk and that, and maybe not inappropriate, not in the equal measure. Don't know. But no offense was meant at all, you know, but it's just talking about these cultural differences and what stands out. And you will find that in, you know, certain forms of Christianity can be very misogynistic, and it's still practiced to this day. And that's very disturbing. And, you know, misogyny, whether it comes from, you know, some forms of religion or even from, and sometimes political reasons is not to be encouraged, and it's not a unique problem to just one group. There. End of statement.
All right.
My pick.
Like any books or movies?
I do. I've been watching, and I'm almost done with the final one. I rewatched the entire Harry Potter series.
Oh, hell yeah.
And I'd never had the opportunity to go, like, watch it all the way through, you know, just like in – certainly not possible in one sitting, but I've been watching it from – you started from the first one, and every night been watching a little bit further, and so I'm almost about a little bit into the Deathly Hallows Part 2. And it is still love the films. I love – like, the first one still holds up for me. I mean, like, you can, you know, look nitpick little details of it, but it's still a great story. And watching those characters evolve over time, watching those actors over time, and watching the story unfold, I just feel so lucky that, like, you know, there are these eight great movies. And the worst movie of them all is still better than most movies I will see at any given time.
Yeah.
So you can get it. I think, like, iTunes has, like, a bundle deal where you can get, like, all eight for $60 or something. They did. They had this weird pricing thing one day, like a couple months ago, where it was like you get all of them for like $10 for the whole thing. It was some, maybe a glitch, wow. But I bought them. So in any event, that's my pick. I think been able to go back and rewatch something like that, thoroughly enjoying it. So,
what is there anything that in rewatching it kind of stuck out to you more on a rewatch than maybe initially hit you when you were seeing them in theaters?
You know, what I love is what in watching them versus reading the books, which I've read the books, but watching them is certainly the evolution of how those children behave around each other was really well done. And watching those kids grow up before your eyes, both, you know, physically, but also just in how the dynamics of how they behave as teenagers, and then watching in the Deathly Hallows, how they become young adults. And that's pretty cool. That's a really neat way to see how, you know, I can't think of any other example in film where we get to see that. We get to watch, you know, starting at 11 to watching somebody become young adults and how they grow as individuals. Except for Ron, but any of it. So that was probably what I took away the most. And just the tone, where the first one's a sort of happy, cheery movie, you know, where the only deaths take place off screen or talked about, to then you get into movies where, you know, the abracadabra curse is done on people right there and they're dying left and right is, you know, amazing. The idea that your audience can, as your audience gets older, you can deal with these older themes.
I also thought, compared to the book, you know, Ralph Fiennes as Voldemort was, it kind of gave you a little bit more of a gravity to that story, mm-hmm. because Voldemort, as you imagine him, he gets fairly limited time in the books because it is obviously Harry's story, and Voldemort is this kind of hanging cloud for the large, you know, saga, and by the time that he shows up, not to say that it's underwhelming in the books, but I think he's not quite the villain that maybe he was, what, you know, the legend that preceded him. But in the movies, when you just see how creepy Ralph Fiennes is, he is, you know, so compelling in a way that maybe didn't quite translate in the written text.
Yeah. Down to the way he holds his wand.
Yeah.
Right. Can we... Now that we're done, all of us pussyfooting around, can we all just share maybe just a little bit of how excited we are about Game of Thrones coming back to HBO?
I mean...
Yeah, you know, whatever.
Oh, screw you. Screw you, dude. Come on.
Hey, Brian, I've been trying to sleep as much as I can between Sundays because I can't wait for each new episode.
Dude, so good.
Right? It totally
oh
is.
Oh, my God.
And at the same time, like, I'm just I'm not only is Game of Thrones so amazing, but it's, like, everything on HBO. Like, I've been watching a full 2 hours of HBO programming every Sunday for the first time since, like, the late 90s because I love Silicon Valley and Veep so much, and they're kind of this great sort of counterpunch to just mollify me for one more hour that, you know, does not – have Game of Thrones, a new Game of Thrones episode in my life. No, it's the storytelling's great. The acting's amazing. If you are up to date with it without spoiling anything, you have laid out very clearly what is going to be the arc, at least for one of our main settings for the rest of the season. And it's,
compelling and awesome and the best.
I know we debated like previous seasons how we felt it got off to a start or whatever, but like I gotta say, this season just hit the ground running.
Well, and plus also like the fact that on the second season they're able to take one of the most controversial moments, one of the most highlight moments, and just throw it out there, not in any kind of like cliffhanger way or whatever, and instead to throw it out, and I'm trying to speak without spoilers, but to set up what clearly will be a multi-episode arc of
Snape kills Dumbledore. There, I said it.
Yes, yes, exactly. I don't know. I'm thrilled, man. It's like we're just gonna win. We're gonna win so hard as viewers watching this stuff.
It's amazing. And really, I mean, we are now to points where the ever-growing smugness of me and my brother and the book readers is starting to evaporate. There are fewer and fewer elements that we know are coming, and there are more and more issues that are kind of still not totally resolved in the books that are now kind of out there, and it's like it's great, it's amazing.
I never got this. It's like I was a guy started reading the book, heard at my agent's office two of the people talking about casting for the, no, I didn't know at the time they're going to do a Game of Thrones miniseries over here casting for this, and I'm like, I'm stopping reading right now, and I'm going to wait for this. But I heard them mention Peter Dinklage as Tyrion.
You made the right call, because to be honest, like I wish I could unread the books. It's the first time in my life where it's like the closest I've gotten to this was I read the first half of the first Lord of the Rings books. I read all of The Hobbit, but halfway through the Lord of the Rings, I was like, too many poems. I'm out. And I'm like, I am so glad I stopped reading those dumb books. This is amazing. And I loved it. Like, but weirdly, Game of Thrones, I wish I could do the reverse. I wish I could unread the books that I've already read.
Well, what's amazing about it is, especially this, not to tip that anything major happens, but George R. R. Martin himself, the author of the books, wrote the teleplay for the most recent episode of Game of Thrones, and it's very interesting to see him be able to kind of fill in little moments, and knowing that it is coming from his hand, elements that are slightly different from the books or moments that are not directly kind of transcribed from his original writing, to find out, you know, kind of where he is going on this kind of second draft of his story. And that's why, I mean, his episodes on a meta level have always been so enjoyable for me. And you know, I think however you do it, they are both worth experiencing. And they are worth experiencing, you know, either from watching the series and then reading the books, or reading the books and then watching the series. It's so good. It's all
right, gentlemen. I'm going to bring this to a close.
Done.
All right.
It's been weird.